Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to take a bite out of the competition? Are you looking for ideas to make your business better? Welcome to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.
Sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
At the core of every successful business, you'll find people making a difference. And with each episode of the Core Business Show, we talk with those people, examine those ideas, and explore the strategies that make them special. Now, the host of the Core Business Show, Tim Jacquet.
Good morning. Welcome to another edition of the Core Business Show. I'm Tim Jacquet, your host. Today, I have the pleasure of having Chris Major. He wrote the book, The Power to Transform, and he's going to talk about also the Human Potential Project, too. If you have any questions, please pose your question in the chat room or text or email. You can text at the number is 214-224-0995. Or you can post your question in the chat room, or you can email me at info@applecapitalgroup. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Great. I guess to begin with, tell us about yourself. A lot of our listeners like to hear personal stories. So kind of share some personal stories on who you are and how you came to be.
Well, I grew up in Eastern Washington. I hit the college campus in 1969, and the spring of 1970, as most of you know, the whole world got turned upside down, and I found myself thrust into a whole different world here. And at that point, I became interested in the whole notion of what was really possible for us as human beings, and I didn't have any real structure in which to shape any of that, so I just kind of went about my life. I was a captain of the college rugby team and played first division for another 8 years afterwards. And about the time I turned 30, my body wouldn't take that anymore, so I took up the study of Aikido, Japanese martial art. And one of my fellow students was a sports psychologist. And in time now, it was about 1980, and this was back when sports psychology was seen as something akin to voodoo or black magic. But this guy had fascinating explanations for experiences that I had and just kind of written off as too many bangs on the head playing rugby or flashbacks to the 60s. And we got to be buddies, and we're just young and naive enough to not know it was impossible. So we started a business that was aimed precisely at pushing the boundaries of human potential, human performance. Our original clients were athletes, and we were interested in athletes for two reasons. One, we'd both been competitive athletes, and two, that was the arena where performance not only mattered, but you were expected to push the boundaries, and that's what we were really fascinated with doing. So that's how we got started on all this stuff and have been at it now for just about 30 years.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah.
Tell us about your journey when you actually started to where you are today, how business has been for you, and if you had like any bumps and struggles or any advice you want to actually give people who had the passion of starting your own business. And these are things, hey, maybe 3 points, hey, you want to really keep your eye on as you grow.
Well, you know, as I tell our clients now, I now have a certain gravitas when I talk about how you run and manage a business, and I earned that by pretty much making all the stupid mistakes that you can make. So when we got started, there was just two of us, and we were working exclusively with individual athletes. And back in those days, Nike and Adidas and everybody didn't exist in the way that they do now. So we had a little flaw number one in our business plan, which was none of our clients could afford to pay us. This is a small but important detail.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, so rule number one, be real clear where what your market is and their capacity. Number two, we then turned our attention to teams, because we saw a bigger possibility here. We saw the same thing that you've seen. I'm sure you probably participated in at some point, which is that we could take a group of individual players who as individuals were terrific, but you put them together on a team and the team would stink. And we go, well, rationally, that makes no sense. So we set about building out a body of work that we came to call team cohesion, which got at the underlying phenomenon that enabled groups to function as a unity. And we did work with Olympic teams, national teams, professional teams. And then, sidebar here, one of the things I found in my career is that if you stay true to your vision and values and are really committed, the universe tends to kind of mobilize around all that. And what we found is that at every step along the way, when we needed a break and it didn't look like we were going to make it, something would unfold. And in this case, we suddenly found ourselves being contacted by the United States Army, which was certainly not on our plans. They had read about stuff we'd done with the military, and we got invited down to Texas, Fort Hood to be precise, and ended up doing almost 3 years sole source work for the United States Army, helping them redesign the way they train soldiers and, to a lesser extent, officers. And that work culminated in a year-long classified project with the Army Special Forces, where we had a programmatic blank check to push the boundaries of human performance. Now, if we hadn't been open to all that and just been really stayed really narrowly focused on our work with athletes, we probably wouldn't be here today. So, you know, there's the moment in time in which you've got to be willing to take a leap, even though you may not know exactly how it's going to turn out or it wasn't certainly part of the plan. But for us, that was a huge, huge shift and critical to our success. Next chapter in the journey was real simple. By about 1985, 1986, I was tired of traveling around to Army bases and living out of the bachelor officers' quarters. And I said to my guys, we're going to turn our attention to a new game, one that's frankly going to be more challenging than working with athletes and working with soldiers, and that's the business world. And the challenge here is there's no timeout, there's no off-season, there's no spring training. By our standards, they don't do any real training. And on any given team, there's a vast gap in the level of competence and commitment on the part of the players. So how do we work in that arena? So we built a little corporate program, tested it on a little tiny subcontractor of Boeing's out in Shelton, Washington, which is a place you've never heard of, and that was intentional. So we said, if it works here, it'll work anywhere, and if it doesn't work here, no one will ever know. Well, it worked beyond our expectations. And then again, you know, Providence kind of smiled on us. We went from that was our first corporate client, little tiny thing called Certified Aerospace, and our second corporate client was AT&T.
Wow.
Yeah, they had read about work that we'd done in the military. They were looking to do a big transformational project because they'd just been through divestiture, and they interviewed 60 firms around the country and chose us, certainly not based on our vast depth of corporate experience. And that launched us into the corporate world, and we've been doing mostly corporate work, but we still keep our hands in and doing work with some sports teams and military stuff. But it's just been a journey of growth, and to say that there hasn't been bumps, oh my gosh, pick your favorite bump. You know, we nearly lost it in a couple of recessions. One of my key partners dropped over dead on me one day. I mean, there's just been all the drama that you would, you know, television series could be made about it. But that's part of what comes with the territory.
Describing that, you know, just let's go back to a footnote real quick. So to explain to the people, what's a sole source award from the military? We have just in case some people don't know.
Sole source is simply, instead of the standard contracting procedure where we put everything out to bid for either security reasons or a unique capability reasons, the government grants what they call a sole source contract. So you're the only ones we're going to talk to and have you deliver it.
Okay, and so there's no bid, no process. I mean, they just use it because you are the specialist in that field.
Right, we're the specialist. Okay. And, you know, for the Special Forces program, it was a highly classified program, so they actually didn't want any publicity going out about it, which is what happens when you put things out to bid. You have to remember that was back in the late 80s, mid-80s, height of the Cold War, different times.
When you talk about, I mean, just having a business partner, was a business a partner? I was making sure that you said passed away.
Yeah. My then business partner, my number one guy in the organization.
So how did you handle that within your business?
Oh, well, as you can imagine, of course, that was totally devastating, both personally, first of all, and professionally. So the first thing we had to do was gather the team and, you know, just kind of let them go through their shock and grieving and whatnot. And then I know it sounds somewhat callous, but the reality is, you know, the show's got to go on. We've still got clients to take care of and so forth, so we had to scramble to see how we're going to replace him and how's the organization going to look different going forward. And it took, oh, I'm going to say, you know, 18 months before we were really kind of back on an even keel, both emotionally and organizationally. And, you know, like any other tragedy, I mean, there's still days, and it's been now coming up on 20-some years.
Oh, wow.
You know, that I go, crap, you know, I wish Jack was here.
Yeah, follow. Wow, sorry for the loss. And when it kind of segue back into the business itself, to talk about the project itself, the Human Potential Project, how did you actually segue into the Human Potential Project?
Well, when we were doing our work with athletes, the company was then called Sports Mind. And the intent was simple. We wanted to bring mostly the mental aspect into the world of performance. And when we got into doing corporate work, after a number of years, we kept bumping up against the fact that everybody thought all we did was kind of outdoor adventure sort of stuff, which is a small portion of what we do. So in 2000, I rebranded the company, and we became the Human Potential Project, because really that's what we're up to, is helping everybody realize more of their innate human potential. And every individual, every organization has a vast reservoir of potential, and everybody kind of intuitively knows that, but what they don't know is how do you go about bringing it to life, and that's what our business is all about.
And when you talk about bringing it to life, can you just name a couple of things that comes to mind that you bring this particular business into life?
Well, we operate in the business world on a couple of kind of contrary to the current common sense premises. First is that if you want to realize any of your potential, you have to understand the phenomenon of how we develop it, how we learn. And most of us in this society are stuck in a deeply dysfunctional view of learning. And unfortunately, our short attention span society has made that worse, not better. So what I'm pointing to is there's really kind of three interpretations or definitions of what it means to learn. There's learn like to become aware of, you know, and this is what you get by listening to little tips and techniques or, you know, watching TV or whatever. You'll see a little flash about something and you go, oh, wow, I never knew anything about that. All right. The second kind of learning is learning as in to understand, where if I say, well, I want to learn some more about this thing I saw or heard, I'll go buy the book, and then I read about it, and I understand it, and then we get stuck thinking that understanding is the end goal, and in fact, it's not. The third type, and what we traffic in, is learning as in the development of new competence, a new capacity for action. In our world, understanding is the booby prize, and we learned this early on with athletes. It didn't matter what they understood. What mattered is what they could do, and they only learn to do things differently by practice. And that's the part that people intuitively know, but somehow think that when it comes to business stuff, that intuition doesn't make any sense, and it makes more sense there. You don't learn to be an effective manager by going to business school. You learn to be an analyst by going to business school or a marketing specialist, but you learn to be an effective manager by getting in the trenches and doing it for a while. Just as you think about anything that you actually ever learned, you didn't learn it from books. So the universal example I always give is learning to drive. So you're in Texas. Did you grow up there?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yes. So when it came time for you to get a driver's license, I'm willing to bet the state of Texas did not say to you, here's this driver's manual, read it, and we'll give you a driver's license, did they?
Oh.
No.
As a teenager,
no. They did not.
No.
No, they didn't say, go to the track and watch these NASCAR guys race around for a while and we'll give you a license. They didn't say, go to this motivational talk by Emerson Fittipaldi or Dale Earnhardt Jr. and then we'll give you a license because you are fired up. No, they said, here's the book. You have to take a test to prove to us that you know what's in the book, but more importantly, you have to show us that you know how to drive a little bit, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and do that, what did you do? You practiced a lot with a driving instructor, which is a job that none of us would want. And then, even then, once you got your license, think back to this, beginning driving was slightly nerve-wracking. That's why, you know, you had both hands on the wheel and your neck was sore from checking all the mirrors all the time and you didn't want anybody talking to you. It's like, don't distract me, man, while I'm trying to drive. And now, however many years later, you can get in the car, fire that thing up, and suddenly, mysteriously, you've arrived at work and you have no idea how you even got there. Right? Because you're not consciously paying attention to it anymore. You have what we call embodied the competence of driving. And that's fundamental to what we do, is we teach what we call embodied competence. We don't traffic in, you know, cheap motivation, no pablum or tips and techniques and any of that stuff, but real live long-term work for building new utilizations of competencies that are aimed at what's really going on in the world, not the world that existed 100 years ago, which is what mostly they teach you in business school.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chris, we're going to take a break real quick. We'll be back in a moment and talk more about the human potential. Be back in one moment with Chris Major. The Power to Transform. Be back.
You're listening to The Core Business Show, sponsored by Apple Capital Group. Apple Capital Group in Jacksonville, Florida, is a commercial lender that specializes in asset-based loans, equipment leasing and financing, invoice financing, commercial real estate loans, and asset-based financing in the U.S. and Canada. Apple Capital Group is a direct lender that lends on their private equity investment portfolio. 90% of most loans are decided within 2 hours, and vendor funding within 24 hours after documents are completed with a one-page application. No slow no's, just a quick decision and a fast yes. To get more information about lending from Apple Capital Group, call 866-611-7457. That's 866-611-7457 to speak with one of our loan specialists. Or visit us right now at applecapitalgroup.com. Welcome back to The Core. Once again, here's Tim Jacquet.
We'll be back with Chris Major again with The Power to Transform. I guess to go back to about HP2, Human Potential 2, is it a particular reason why you call it HP2, or it's just is it a second part of a phase?
Well, no, it's just, you know, if you look at the name Human Potential Project, so you got an H and two Ps. So
okay.
It's just abbreviation, I know. There'd like to be some great mystical thing to it. But no, it's just a short version of Human Potential Project, HP2. I mean, the real blunt truth is it just doesn't sound good to go around saying HPP, so we like HP2.
Wow. You know, if you really, with athletes, I think they learn from failure. Is that the same premises that and learn how to become better? Is that the same premise? And when you actually train, how to look for all the bad things as well as the good things so you can look at the whole picture?
Well, you do need to look at the whole picture, but let's see how to say this. You know, athletes don't necessarily learn by failure. What we want them to do is learn a little bit from failure. And the challenge here is, if you're not really pushing yourself, then you're not going to fail. So the thing with athletes is we want them to really push the boundaries of what's possible. Then at some moment, they're going to, quote, fail. But the thing you want to be careful of is, all right, we may or may not have set a world record, but that doesn't necessarily mean we failed. So the dilemma with that is if we get this notion of failure in our heads, then it becomes very problematic to kind of break out and get people moving. In the business world, we work on what we call mood management. And that's the most important job that a leader in an organization has, is managing the mood in the organization. And that has to do with producing ambition and confidence and trust. And when you produce those three things, then people are much more willing to stretch. And, yeah, we will eventually bump up against the point where our ambitions exceed our competencies, but if we can do that in the space of, hey, we're all in this together and we're going to rally around and give it a better shot next time, that's a much different conversation than, oh, we failed.
Talking about failure. Why do most corporate development initiatives fail?
Oh, good question. Well, frankly, it goes back to what we were saying about learning. They are stuck in this antiquated view of learning, and instead of trying to build authentic new competence, they traffic in tips and techniques and understanding. So you see this notion of, oh, well, we're going to do this one-day seminar on this or this half-day seminar on that, and it just never, ever works, and people get more and more cynical about the phenomenon, and then rather than trying to do things properly, they try and do it even shorter because now they're under pressure from, well, we're too busy and we don't have enough time. And if you look at it, if the offerings that most corporations made actually delivered on their promise, you couldn't keep people out of the programs. Instead, you've got a mandate that they go to them because everybody knows they don't work.
Wow. So how can you change that mindset for the ones that know they're people that, okay, it doesn't work. Another person say, okay, I just want to get away from the office. Another person, well, you know, you have these different personalities, different motives that employees look for, managers look for just to get things done. Or, hey, I do this to make my boss happy, to make sure, you know, I look like I'm doing something. How do you take that approach within your project?
Well, you know, when we work with a company, our client is always the CEO. And he or she has hired us because they're really committed to crafting a different future for the organization. If you talk to most people right now, particularly at senior leadership, they will quietly say to you that the way we're working right now is not sustainable. Everybody is stressed out. We're overwhelmed. And we just can't keep this up. We keep trying to do more with less. And there's a moment in time where it doesn't work and people are starting to come unglued. So our clients are the CEOs. We coordinate with the HR folks, but only for the sake of how we deploy our work. And then, as you said, I'm just making up numbers now, give me a room of 100 people. Of that 100, and I've watched this now for 30 years, they will be divided into three almost identically sized subsets, and it happens every single time. Doesn't matter what company, what country. And you kind of called them out. There's a group, the first third, who walk in there, and they're all excited, and this is great, and we don't even know what's going to happen, but since we're doing something, I can hardly wait. Then there's the third, we call them, as you call them, vacationers. This could be great, this could suck, doesn't really matter to me because I don't have to work, so you guys go ahead and do what you're going to do. And then there's the third that we call the prisoners, and their mindset is, this sucks, you suck, the boss sucks, that I have to be here sucks, go ahead and teach me something, I dare you. Now, what happens with us is because of the way we work, and we do a lot of experiential things, and we work with people's bodies, by the time we're done, about 99% of the group are over in that we're all excited. And those people that used to be the prisoners now become your biggest advocates. You can't do that by just talking to people. You've got to have the methodologies that we use where you actually work with their bodies, get these moods of cynicism and distrust and resentment and arrogance out of them and replace them with ambition and confidence and esprit, and that's what we do for 4.5 days.
Well, in those 9.5 days, any particular success stories that stands out with you?
Well, we got a zillion of them. So let's go back to our very first one. I was telling you about AT&T. The consumer products division was 40,000 people losing $220 million a year until divestiture. They got AT&T got broken up, and the board said to consumer products, you've got 18 months to get this thing profitable. If you can't do it, we will just shut it down and do retail through Sears. Consumer products was all of their phone stores and business offices. So the first thing they did, like all establishment companies, they called McKinsey. McKinsey comes in and takes the headcount from 40,000 to 16,000 in 9 months. So just kind of get your head wrapped around that. Yep. And they were very proud of themselves because their job was to stop the financial hemorrhaging, which, in fact, they had done. Unfortunately, they were kind of oblivious to the fact that everything else had stopped as well. And our job was to breathe life back into this thing. So we got handed the mandate to deliver what came to be known as Project Miracles. We put 6,000 managers through 4.5 days of intensive work and some follow-up work. And over the following 48 months, that one division went from break-even to generating a cumulative total of over $3 billion in profit for AT&T. Outside of long distance, they became the most profitable part of the business. Out of that, AT&T tried to buy us a couple times. And that's the way that we work. We do massive transformational stuff. We don't settle for incrementalism, and I could give you a dozen stories of that same kind of magnitude.
Wow. And that same, you know, if AT&T was trying to buy you, I was trying to wrap my head around it. So they didn't, you know, say, hey, I give you stock, part of AT&T. Become a part of us. Was that something, as a business owner, you will lose your identity once you become part of them. Now you're on their game plan. Was that the mindset, the reason that you didn't want to get bought by them?
That was certainly the biggest part of it. And the other part was, you know, I'm from the West Coast. I didn't really want to move to New Jersey, to put it bluntly. But the main thing is what you said. I didn't at that point want to be part of some big corporation. And if you look at what happened to AT&T, I'm very grateful I didn't make that choice, you know, because I would have been sitting on a really big boatload of now worthless stock.
Wow. And the same thing is like Ted Turner had his issues with Time Warner.
Yeah, exactly.
Kick it like it's a nightmare, which everyone from the outside thought was a nightmare. Anyway, why? And why merge those two entertainment companies together with two different cultures? Then add Amazon, AOL. Didn't make sense either. So,
right.
I know he's still kicking himself, but he's still rich, so. Really.
Yeah, he's not suffering.
No, he's not suffering. Maybe hurt for a few numbers. Any kind of ugly stories that things. Maybe not necessarily went the way you thought they would be. The manager decided to do their own thing after going through their training and then didn't understand it, or they finally maybe turned around and saw the light.
I know it sounds crazy, but actually, no, we don't have any big nightmare stories. I mean, the closest thing we've got is we were working with one big company that we'd done a lot of work with, and one of the divisions decided they wanted to do a lot of the background support on their own because it looked kind of simple, because we do it so smoothly it looks seamless, and they, to put it bluntly, kind of botched it up. So we had 60 people show up for a program that was supposed to last for 9 months, and they thought they were there for 2 days. that was a little bit of a problem. It took us a while to overcome that, but we got it turned around. See, because our work unfolds over time and people have, we do on-site coaching, we do these conferences and coaching in between, we really have a firm pulse on where they are with the stuff. We know who's doing the work, we know who's not, we see how it's working in the company, because what we do is we have the company pick a set of projects that become the vehicle by which we teach the new practices. And the projects have to be critical to the business, have a financial impact, and be complex enough that they think that it's going to take about a year to get them done. And we show them how, using our methodologies, they either produce more value or get them done faster. And by the time we get done with all that, there's really not much opportunity for guys to really, you know, muck it up or take it all sideways. So we don't have any big, you know, here's where we hit the wall stories.
Okay. We're going to take a call at 309.
Yes,
caller,
hello.
You're on the air. Hi.
Great.
You can pose your question to the guest.
Yes, as I wrote in the chat room, the question comes after a bit of description of my story. So I'm an aspiring entrepreneur with an interest in ammonia, otherwise known as NH3, which can be used as an agricultural fertilizer, potential transportation engine fuel, and an electricity storage medium. So I'm reaching a few points of significant progress, but I'm scared that in the process I may be outcompeted by others who may have similar ideas, and perhaps with the risk that I may be cut out of the loop. So are there skills, options, or actions that would be good for me to use to stay in the game, per se?
Well, that's a really good question, and as you well know, if you're going to be playing in this game of fertilizer and energy and stuff, there's some very big players in the space, and it can often be difficult for the small entrepreneur to make a break into there. So what I would point you to is maybe your best strategy, and I say maybe with a big underline under it, is to look at who might be an ally with you in this, who might you be able to partner up with, because if you're not careful, it is easy for the little guys to get swallowed up and kind of kicked to the roadside. But this power of good ideas and compelling technologies is always going to have a strong toehold in any market. So part of it is the combination of stick-to-itiveness, and you might also look and see who's a good strategic partner for you so you're not out there going it alone.
Right. Thanks. That's helpful. And I have been working with a local innovation center that has a nonprofit based there that is actually connected to my state of Indiana Department of Commerce. So I guess there's some interest on this kind of consulting firm that helps match the entrepreneur to the resources to go forward and then the investors. So maybe that's a good place to be right now.
Well, that sounds like a good place to be in, and I don't know where in Indiana you are, but in most every state, there's some what they call angel investor groups. Who are people that put money into startups knowing that, you know, this is just the beginning stage, and they tend to be successful entrepreneurs themselves and can help you with all the work you need on business plans and also helping you find good allies.
Right. Okay. Wonderful.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, keep
thank
up the
you.
Good stuff.
Appreciate you calling.
For sure. Yep. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. Take care. Bye-bye. Okay, last question real quick. Regarding why business schools are not really teaching these skill sets. Is it a sense that they just so focus on this particular curriculum that, you know, they're not teaching, you know, the Six Sigma, they're not, you know, all of these type of certifications that propel you to do better, they're not teaching our project management. Why isn't it? Why is that?
Well, now you're stepping in it here, my friend.
Oh, okay.
All right, here we go.
Inquiring minds want to know.
That's it, right. So here's the deal. If you look at what we call, quote, modern management practices, which includes pretty much the bulk of most business school curriculum, these all were things that were invented by guys in the 1800s. They were deployed in the early 1900s to be effective in the then emerging industrial era. So if you look at everything that we call management, it was all designed to maintain order, avoid surprises, produce predictability. All of our financial accounting, our HR philosophies, et cetera, were all designed to be effective in Henry Ford's Model T factories, right? That was the industrial era. In the industrial era, people worked out of survival. There was no social safety net, so if you lost your factory job, you starved. Well, needless to say, the world has changed. And today, the value generators in the economy are not the industrial era workers. They're what we call coordination workers. These are people who are educated, they're agile, they're mobile, they're creative, they're innovative, they're problem solvers. And they produce value out of their effective coordinations with each other to take care of customer concerns. Now, unlike the old industrial era workers who worked out of survival, these people have three completely different drivers. First is autonomy, right? Because I'm educated, I don't need some guy standing over my shoulder telling me what to do every 5 minutes, which is what we think management is. Most people think that management is just a fancy word for supervision. Not so. So the first thing that drives them is autonomy. The second thing is mastery. We want to learn to develop our skill set so we can continue to make a difference in the world. And the third thing is meaning or purpose. We want what we do to have some kind of bigger meaning. There is no business school curriculum that recognizes those three drivers. And in fact, most contemporary management practices often demean those three things as the dreaded touchy-feely stuff. Mm-hmm. If we can shift, and the reason that they don't teach any of this stuff is because education, unfortunately, is one of the slowest sectors of our economy to adopt innovations. The professors there all got schooled in the old stuff. They all write books about the old stuff. They comment, you know, with more or less insight about what's going on in the world, but then they go right back to teaching that which they've already known, because that's the easiest path forward.
Wow. So it's no use to, and also maybe you're thinking that, hey, they don't want to shake any feathers.
Mm-hmm.
It
would be a massive disruption. We'd have to completely overhaul all of our curriculums. We'd have to get completely new textbooks. We'd have to put emphasis on whole different skill sets. And much of and the biggest thing we have to do is come to the realization and actually say to the world, you know, we need to change. Much of what we're teaching is irrelevant these days. They're not willing to do that.
Well, do you think also, as we go in the future, you have social media and new things coming up, do you think that they're going to be forced to make a change over time?
Well, yeah, of course they are. The question that you, the key qualifier you put there was over time. See, here's our dilemma. We claim that we're going to be the big innovation economy. And if you look back over the last 20, 30 years, go back to the 80s. We decided, kind of unconsciously, that it was okay to essentially shut down our entire manufacturing sector. We told ourselves a story that, well, we don't really need all those dirty industrial era jobs, you know, so never mind the fact that the whole Ohio Valley is being dissembled and shipped off overseas, and all these people are now unemployed, because we're going to be the technology drivers of the world. We're going to build computers and write all the software, and, you know, everybody smiled and nodded. And the Japanese figured out how to make computers just as well and cheaper than we could, so our computer manufacturing went overseas. But we told ourselves we're going to be the software leaders, and then the Chinese and Indians figured out how to do software, if not better, at least dramatically cheaper. And next thing you know, we've outsourced all that. So now we're telling ourselves we're going to be the innovation economy, but then you have to look and go, well, where are these innovators going to come from? We're doing a really poor job of training them in our school system, because we frankly don't need innovators in sociology and English literature. We need innovators in science and technology and engineering and math, and we're just not getting the job done at any level. So, You know, we've got to look and see as a nation, you know, are we going to be content to, you know, be a country that's, you know, a tourist attraction, call centers, and burger flippers, or are we going to get our gumption back here and overhaul things, including our educational system, so that we really can be the innovators of the future?
Wow. And lastly, Chris, anything you would like to leave us with?
Well, you know, it's funny because I've been doing a tour about my book of late, so I would suggest if people really want to learn a little bit more about what we're up to, pick up the book, The Power to Transform. There's also a site, and I want to say, you know, I resisted writing a book for years because, as I keep telling people, you don't learn anything from books. What you get is awareness of what you might want to learn. And then as the Internet progressed, it finally got to the point where we could interact with people electronically, so that the book is actually just a access portal. It, of course, contains content, but it drives you to the website where you can interact with other people, and there's a series of assignments that produce this embodiment that I've been talking about. So mostly what I would leave people with is an invitation to go and check out the site, thepowertotransform.net, or you can get on Amazon or most any other major bookseller and pick up a copy of the book, The Power to Transform, and really dive into it. And I promise you that new and great things will open up for you.
Wow. And that website again is?
ThePowerToTransform.net. And you can go check out our company site, which is HumanPotentialProject.com. And there's links to both sites on both sites.
Well, great. Well, Chris, thank you for joining the program today.
My pleasure. Hope that was useful.
It was. Thank you. I appreciate it. Take care.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, it's been another production of The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. Thank you guys for listening. You can download this episode on iTunes and on Blog Talk Radio. Everybody, have a great day and take care.
Thank you for listening to The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.
For a free quote on equipment leasing and financing, visit our website, applecapitalgroup.com. That's applecapitalgroup.com. And fill out the information to receive your free quote. We hope you'll join us for our next episode. And remember, you can always get to the core via iTunes. You'll find all our previous episodes there. Thanks again for listening to The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.